God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you.
My name is Dana. I'm an alcoholic.
Dana, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic and an addict, and I'm on day one.
Stephanie, love you, girl. Glad you're here. Anybody else?
Okay. I'm Evan. So I've been here before, but I got 2 weeks tomorrow. So.
All right. Welcome. Glad you're here, Evan. Awesome. All righty. All right. I am going to now disallow the unmuting. Let's see. Okay, we got that. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous states that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to welcome Anna C. from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, to tell her story. And after she tells her story around the top of the hour, we'll take a short break. We'll call for announcements, pass the seven tradition basket, et cetera. And then we'll reconvene and ask her questions. So you'll see in the chat a user called Questions. It's really Larry. But as questions occur to you, if there's anything that you would like for Anna to answer, then go ahead and send those questions to Larry. And so I don't want to take up another minute of Anna's time. Please help me welcome Anna.
Thank you, David. My name is Anna, and I am an alcoholic. It's very nice to be with you guys and see all your little faces on here tonight. And thank you for asking me to speak. My sober date is October 7th of 2012. My home group is the Tar Heel group here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, as of 2 months ago when I moved from Miami in August. And before that in Boston. So I've been sober now in three different home groups. I have a sponsor. I actually shared here with her maybe a few months ago that I know some of you guys remember. So I'm really glad to be back. And this is a cool meeting format. Hopefully I feel intimidated by you guys asking me questions on the spot, but hopefully the good news is I don't have anything that I need to answer. I just have to tell you my experience. So that's what I'm going to do. So to start off, I've been taught with sharing a story that I share what I was like, what happened and what I'm like now. And I've been taught that it's important that it's what I was like, and what happened and what I am like now and not what it was like. Because, it being life in a lot of ways, my problem wasn't that my life was challenging. It was that I was living it, I always think about that when I start and I use that part of the big book. But my experience is that I was a really, really anxious, fearful kid, extremely. I had fears of things happening that there was no reasonable likelihood of it happening. I would go to bed and I would pray that my whole family wouldn't die while I was asleep, or I would, you know, be at my grandmother's house and my parents would be 5 minutes late and I'd be afraid that they died to come in to get me. You know, I would be afraid that I would come home from school and that my parents wouldn't recognize me. You know, the like just really outlandish, bizarre. I don't know who put the ideas in my head. I never needed to watch a horror movie or take any hallucinogens. Like I was, I just came out of the factory with those fears. So I don't know what that's all about. And I don't even think that it makes me alcoholic. But what I can tell you is that it did make me very anxious from a very young age. Like the earliest prayers I can remember saying, or like I said, God, please don't let my family die, you know, whatever. And that's really like, you know, my only experience with praying when I was little, like I didn't have any like super religious upbringing. God wasn't really like central to what we talked about. You know, my family was for all intents and purposes, like, you know, I grew up in a pretty nice place, in Massachusetts, and, I had friends, you know, like I was well-liked and I was just so afraid all the time. And I, from a very young age as well, I was a figure skater and, you know, I would get up at 4:30 in the morning to go to practices when I was like 9 years old, you know, and, I've just always been one of those people that was like, you know, high achieving, trying really hard. Maybe if I move my legs fast enough, like the duck, you know, they're not going to see the fact that my feet are paddling so fast underneath and I'll just sail smoothly across the water. Then maybe I'll be okay, you know? And so what happened for me is that, by the time I was, I think like 11 years old, I had been hospitalized for anxiety, with something called cyclical vomiting. I couldn't stop throwing up because I was having physical reactions to how afraid I was all the time. And I've shared that story from the podium and I ended up sponsoring a woman who also has cyclical vomiting. And I was like, maybe I should be more specific when I say that, you know, if you have anxiety in different ways, like that's totally fine. That was my experience as I was making myself sick. But not purposefully, like it just fit, like I couldn't help it. And so, you know, that happened a couple of times and my parents sent me to, psychotherapy in the form of, like, what's the word? Not meditation, but, like a hypnotist. That's the word I'm looking for. They tried to fix it with hypnosis, hypnotherapy. And honestly, for a while, like, you know, I would listen to these tapes and, it would calm me down. And I really feel like today that was like my first experience of a spiritual solution to my problem of fear and self-centered fear. And what's going to happen to me? Am I going to lose something that I have? Am I not going to get something? Is the other shoe going to drop? It was like a spiritual connection that I didn't even know that's what I was getting. But today, the way I understand like a spiritual connection is I really think that's what was happening. And, you know, it worked really well for a time. I stopped getting so anxious. I was able to like have these tools when fear came up, you know, I would put on basically a guided meditation, but they weren't as accessible as they are now. And, you know, with YouTube and everything, but I would put on like my cassette. I had my little cassette with the individual tape player. And then I would be able to like calm down and not get sick and relieve some of that fear just a little bit. But honestly, you know, that was when I was like 12 years old and, there was no alcohol in my house growing up at all. My mom comes from an alcoholic family. She is an adult child of an alcoholic. My dad, you know, had been in and out of some 12-step programs, but for whatever reason, they both decided that they didn't want any alcohol in the house growing up. I think largely driven by my mom's experience of growing up in an alcoholic home and my dad sort of being willing to go along with it. And so I had like a firm resolution through all these like fears and all this stuff. Like I never wanted to drink. I thought it was terrible. Like I didn't understand it at all because I never saw adults. Like my grandmother did drink when we would go out to restaurants and stuff. But, you know, I just never really saw it as being like, I don't have any of those memories that people talk about. Like I would see the adults and then they would be drinking and they'd be laughing and that looked like the solution. I never had that. Like I didn't make that connection at all. Honestly, I didn't want to drink. I was like firmly against it for whatever reason. Like when I was, you know, 12 and 13 years old, which I guess is like sort of normal, but whatever. I was, you know, I was very against doing it. And, but then when I was 14, and I got into high school, and that the first example I saw of watching people having fun and seeing that as something that I wanted was people my age who got drunk and went to dances in ninth grade. And they just looked like they were having so much more fun than I was. And so I decided that, you know, maybe that was something that I wanted to try. And when I drank alcohol for the first time, I was in Plymouth, Massachusetts at my friend's grandmother's house. We stole alcohol from her, you know, liquor cabinet under the stairs or whatever. And I sat there and I was so afraid of what it was going to taste like. I was so afraid of what it was going to do to me. I mean, I'm a very anxious kid, so I'm full of fear all the time, right? And all I can tell you is that when I drank, I loved it. You know, like I absolutely loved it. I loved everything that came along with it. I immediately wanted to like text people and call people and prank, you know, and just like act. I wanted to act how I'd always wanted to act, but I was too afraid to do it, you know? And I felt like alcohol gave me this shield that I could really be the most authentic version of myself without being so afraid of everyone's opinions of me all the time, because I lived in this prison and I didn't know it, of being afraid of what you thought about me and afraid of messing up, you know? And that was really like, those are the roots of my fears. And so I loved that. And I was 14 when that happened. And I honestly can tell you that like from that point on, drinking, like they talk about in Bill's story in the Big Book, like drink took on an increasingly important role in my life. Like that is my experience. Like it just, it wasn't something where all of a sudden I became a daily drinker because I was 14. I realized I've heard stories in AA that that's actually happened for people. That wasn't possible for me because I didn't have any alcohol in my house. I mean, I looked like a 14-year-old. There was no getting around that, going to like liquor stores in Massachusetts that are really strict, you know, and they don't sell alcohol in grocery stores or anything. Believe me, I thought about it, how unfair that was. But I wasn't able to get alcohol that often. Like I was able to get it on the weekends. And so I became a weekend warrior, and I just lived to get through the week so that I could get to the weekend. I could be with my friends, I could get drunk, and then, you know, I would recover in the early part of the week, and I would just think about the next weekend over and over and over again. And, you know, I started drinking in June when I was 14, and by December, I was drinking 100 proof liquor because it was faster, you know, and I would find people who wanted to buy it for me, who were like upperclassmen who had brothers or whatever, and you know, they deliver the 100 proof liquor in Dasani water bottles and all that disgusting stuff and, you know, back alleys and way, way more dramatic than it needed to be. But at the same time, like I just loved the effect produced by alcohol. I have never drank for taste. 100 proof liquor still at 8 years sober, I still think that makes sense. If you like the effect produced by alcohol, why would you not drink stronger alcohol? It just seems logical to me. But anyways, so I switched to that, and I started, you know, I started getting sick a lot. I started getting alcohol poisoning a lot. And I know that's shocking that I was 15 drinking 100 proof liquor and getting alcohol poisoning. So, you know, I just remember this one time, and it really sticks out in my memory. And so my mom's birthday is December 17th. So I know it was her birthday, and it was in that first year of drinking. And I remember going to my friend's house, drinking a bunch of vodka with her and two boys. And, you know, I had no, like, I was somebody who like had no interest in, like, I just wanted to get drunk. I did not care who I was with or what I was doing. Like, I didn't like it. What, like there was, I don't mention that there were like friends or boys there for any particular reason. Like I was with my 100 proof liquor, like alone in the kitchen, you know what I mean? And so I got really sick, and my dad came and picked me up the next day, and he drove me to like this Boston Market parking lot in near my friend's house. And he just, you know, like I had gone out the night before I went to my friend's house with the boys and the vodka. I had gone out for my mom's birthday dinner, and it was like the restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness that they talk in the Big Book, like that is, I was like, if they could have put a video alongside the definition of that in the dictionary, it would have been me at this dinner. the appetizer, like, why do you want appetizers? Why do you need dessert? You know, like, you can have, like, why is this taking so long? Do you really have to get the thing? You know, like, it was just like, I didn't understand why they were taking so long to get through this stupid dinner when I had places to go and people to see, you know, mostly things to drink. And I was just a nightmare. And like, I, and the thing was, is that it was a complete personality shift from when I was younger. Like that's what really my family started to notice the most, is I just became impossible to be around. You know, like I was withdrawn, like all the stuff they talk about of like signs to watch for in case your teen is like going off the deep end. Like that was me, you know? And I just was withdrawn. I didn't want to be anywhere with my family. They were always a burden. I wanted to be out of the house all the time. My grades started to fall. And anyway, so the next day when my dad came and picked me up, just to frame where the conversation was at, given the situation the night before, he said to me, you know, your mom's really upset with you. And if you keep on the way that you're behaving, you know, I'm going to ignore the fact that you smell like alcohol right now. And if you keep on the way that you're behaving, you're not going to be welcome at family events in our family. Like you're not going to be welcome anymore. Like this is not acceptable behavior. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm somebody who has always really loved my parents. I mean, here we go. Like my first biggest fear was that they wouldn't recognize me or that they would die. They were like at the top of my list of priorities in terms of importance when I was a kid, and debatably still today. But you know, in this period of time when alcohol was taking a bigger seat in the audience for me, you know, I heard what he was saying, and it's not like it didn't upset me that he and my parents were noticing this, but it wasn't enough. Like it didn't tick off any like alert that there was something that I had to do differently around whether or not I drank. It was just like, oh, I just have to figure out a way to do it better. You know, I have to figure out a way to not turn on any alarm bells for them that there's something wrong, because that might mean that they intervene with what I'm doing, and that's not an option, you know? And so I'm pretty sure I just said something to like I said, like the duck paddling its feet. Like I was very manipulative, still can be. I just needed to get them off my back, you know? And so I said whatever I needed to say. I apologized to whoever I needed to apologize to, namely my dad and my mom. And, you know, I went on my merry way. I can tell you, like, I remember the conversation very well. It did nothing to stop my drinking. I changed nothing. It meant nothing. And, you know, that would continue on. Like that was when I was 15, and my dad and my mom tried so many times to break through to me, you know? And, there's a part in the 12 and 12 that I really like. And it talks about, that, you know, that there's a type of newcomer, I think it's in the fourth step. And they talk about how there's a type of newcomer who is really belligerent, and that these types of newcomers scarcely need comforting. What they need is a chink in the walls that their ego has built so that the light of reason can shine through. And I think that that's like, first of all, very beautiful. I may be misquoting it, but I know that there's at least light of reason is definitely in there, because it sticks out as a reference to God for me. But, you know, all I can tell you is that at that point, and up until I was 22 when I got sober, there were no chinks. Things tried to penetrate over and over and over again, and it just never got through to me. It just, I just couldn't see it. So in any event, fast forward, you know, like I started going to the hospital for alcohol poisoning. I lost groups of friends, mostly because they didn't want to hang out with me because I got sick all the time. I got alcohol poisoning all the time. I was a miserable person to be around. And so I would switch groups of friends. I would switch, you know, what I was drinking. By my senior year of high school, I drank only beer because I figured out that if I drank hard alcohol, that would be a problem. So like I literally did what they talked about in Dr. Bob's Nightmare in the Big Book, where they do the beer experiment. I always identify with that. You know, for a period of time, I thought, oh, I'll drink only wine, because when you drink wine, you only get happy drunk. Come to find out, that's not the case. You know, and so by the time I went to college, and mind you, like, here I am, I'm somebody, like I said, who, if I make it all look okay on the outside, if I achieve enough, then all this stuff that's going on over here, like, maybe you won't pay attention to it. And maybe you won't pay attention to it, meaning maybe I won't pay attention to it either. Maybe it's all fine. If it's all happening, you know, in its own little enclosed space, and I can still perform well over here, then it's all okay. And so, you know, I graduated from high school based on what everything I just told you. I also still graduated from high school in National Honor Society. I got recruited to go to college to row, and like boats. And, you know, I went as an engineer. I was an engineering student, and I went to college, and, all I can say is that, like, the wheels just kind of, like, fell off of my life. You know, I started drinking more. And I didn't have sort of like the buffer of friends that had known me, like, all growing up. You know, I had to, like, meet people, and they had to like me for who I was, like, today. And who I was today was not that great, you know. And I couldn't show up for things. You know, I failed out of my engineering school. I had to switch majors. I quit the rowing team in my first year of college, because you have to wake up really early, and it was just not working for me. And, you know, I was also somebody who, I was a pianist when I went to college. I quit playing piano. I quit everything. I stopped doing anything. I just basically was like, all right, I can't drop out of college, because then, like, something will be really wrong. I had reasons for why all those other things fell apart. You know what I mean? It was not because I was an alcoholic. It was because this, you know, the people, it was putting me into a box. I didn't want to only spend time with those types of people. I didn't, you know, whatever it was, whatever delusion I was in. And so, by the time I was, a junior in college, I went to Spain for 6 months to study, and, I blacked out in a lot of foreign countries. You know, that's pretty much my experience of studying abroad. I got sent home early, because, I couldn't function. I got sent to a therapist while I was there. They're all trying to figure out what's wrong with me. And the thing was too, is that I was trying to figure out what was wrong with me too. I did not understand how can you be miserable when you get this opportunity to do all this amazing stuff? I didn't understand. And to this day, I still feel like kind of ashamed that was the way that I felt. It's not that I wasn't grateful for the opportunity. It's just, I was so wrapped up in me that I just couldn't even see how blessed I was. And I couldn't, like, it was just all, it just felt like everything was on top of me all the time. And drinking was the only time I got a break. And so I just kept doing that, you know, and, I came home early, and I thought, you know, I was already on probation at school for academic and disciplinary reasons. And I got put on another level of disciplinary probation. Why you get so many strikes for it, I don't know. At the time, I can tell you, I did not see that as lenient. I thought that they were, you know, so terrible. And, I would tell anybody who would listen to me how terrible they all were at that college. And mind you, like, they literally, I had 3 strikes and they had not kicked me out. You know, like, I don't know how that's not lenient. If anything, that's a little bit cosigny. But, and you know, what happened is, at some point within college, like, I think it was during my sophomore year of college, I decided that, you know, after a particular, I woke up in what can only be described and what I talked about at the time before I, like, was introduced to AA, and it gave me a language to describe alcoholism and what that feels like to wake up after a night of drinking. I used to call them anxiety hangovers, where, like, I had drunk because I was so full of fear and I just needed a break and all that stuff. And then the thing was that I always hated so much was when the alcohol wore off in the morning, it was worse. And so I was left with, like, more of me than I had started with. And it was unbearable. And so I was sitting in that, you know, I'm 19 years old, and I was kind of watching TV all day, you know, and avoiding contact with any other human beings as one does when they don't want to know what they did the night before. And I was sort of just like looking at the TV, but not really watching it. You know what I mean? Because I was so in my head, like nothing, there was no sound coming in my ears. And so I said to my mom, you know, I think I have a problem with alcohol. And mind you, like I've been to the hospital now, like it's not really shocking. My mom's like smelling my breath when I'm going to sleep. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's not. And so she just looks at me and she's like, okay. You know, and like I said, like my mom is an adult child of an alcoholic and my dad had been to some 12-step meetings. So she's like, why don't we go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? And I remember, like, I feel like most of our reactions are, I was like, oh, no. Like that, no. I think I have misspoken, you know, I just need a little bit of help, you know? And for whatever reason, I went with her. She could probably, because she drove me and didn't really give me an option. She drove me to my first AA meeting, which was in Brookline, Massachusetts. And all I remember being there is, you know, I thought to myself, this isn't that hard. I don't understand why everyone here is making such a big deal out of not drinking. If I decide I don't want to drink, I'm just not going to drink anymore. So I'm deciding that now, and I'm going to leave here, and I don't need to ever see these people again, who at the time, all I can remember from that meeting, honestly, is people crying when they got up to share. Like it was a speaker discussion meeting, I think. And like, I felt like every person who shared cried. And as somebody like I have laid out for you, you know, like I was somebody who really prided myself on being fine all the time. And this was like so pathetic. Like you guys were all like really letting all your crazy hang out and you're crying and you did not like it. I gotta be honest. I was like, this just does not seem better than the option of crying by myself. Like why would I want to hang out with you guys and cry, you know? And so I left and I made sure to tell a bunch of people that I had been to an AA meeting so they could get the F off my back, you know? And I was drunk again in 3 weeks. And so that, you know, but the thing was, is it wasn't because I didn't have a choice, right? Quote unquote. In my mind, I changed my mind. I have new information. I had overreacted. And actually the reason I had gotten sick that last time was because I didn't eat enough before I went out. And if I had had a bigger dinner, I would never have ended up in that AA meeting, you know? And I really, like, I can tell you that with all of my heart, every time I went back to drinking after trying to stop, I believed the reasons that I was doing it were sound. And so I, this started this period of time and, you know, from 19 to 22, where I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. And like I said, like, I mean, I went to AA when I was 19, that was before I studied in Spain and before I, you know, got put on another level of probation and before I had to look, you know, the president of my university in the eyes and him tell me that he wanted to kick me out, but he didn't have enough evidence. And before I tried to get back with the same ex-boyfriend for the, you know, the fifth year in a row. I mean, I just couldn't see that alcohol was the common denominator. And I got sent to, after one of the times I got in trouble, I think I got taken away from like a school event in an ambulance or something for I don't know exactly. I don't remember. But, you know, I got sent to an alcohol counselor and he worked on the campus or whatever. And he was the only person that I felt like wasn't trying to come at me with sort of like scare tactics. That's how I felt about everyone else, like my parents, the president of the university, my rowing coach, like they all were trying this method of like, you're going to die and you're throwing your life away and the thing is, come to find out the alcohol counselor is 30 years sober in AA. I found that out when I made amends to him, but it really wasn't shocking because he was the only person who didn't come at me like that. And all I can say is that for me, this alcoholic, like it's very, if someone attacks like that and tells me how horrible it all is, I immediately, my alcoholism defends itself immediately. I immediately put up all the reasons why they're wrong, you know, and, you know, I would have my, you know, I was at this point where like, if I didn't pick up my phone, my parents were driving over to come see if I was dead. You know, it was not a good situation, but I would go to this alcohol counselor and I would clearly be a mess, like having just been crying or whatever. And he'd be like, are you okay? And of course, like, because of who I am as a person and, you know, my character defects, I'd be like, I'm fine. And of course I wasn't fine. How creepy, right? Like I have like, I obviously look like I was just crying. And he would just be like, okay, you know, and he wasn't like, no, you're clearly lying or like, you know, and like, honestly, that's the same type of experience as when I came into AA and I stayed. And, you know, what that looked like for me is I finally got to this place, you know, I did go to meetings in that period of time, but nothing really worth discussing because like, for me, like I said, I would go to a meeting and then I would be like, well, I'm not going to go to the meeting next week because, you know, the time would come where I would have to go to the meeting again that I had been to previously. And I'd be like, well, it's raining, you know, like no one, I'm sure no one goes to AA when it's raining, you know, like, and I know that sounds stupid, but it's like, I really believed like, and at the time too, I believed maybe it was like church or something. Like I didn't think people went to more than one AA meeting a week until I actually got a sponsor. I really thought it was something like church where like you check in once a week, which like, by the way, there's people who go to church more than once a week too. But in my mind, like I thought that like you go like, you know, on Saturdays or whatever. And even that I couldn't fit in, you know? And so I just never was willing to get all the way in. I just thought I was different. And when I finally was able to get well was when I came into AA, and I like to say that like at the time I really thought I was coming back to AA. I had never been in AA. Like that's the real God's honest truth. If I haven't done what people in AA are doing, I may have been in an AA meeting. I went back to an AA meeting. I did not go back to AA, you know? And so, you know, just, I feel like that's important. I always try to like tell sponsees that if they end up leaving AA is like, of course you're like more than, no one wants to keep you here if you don't want to be here. I will say though, like if whatever you go to look for and have work for you does not work, there are things here you didn't try. And so I was really lucky to know that there were a lot of things in AA that I hadn't tried. Because I think if I had thought that I had tried AA and it hadn't worked, I wouldn't have come back to a meeting, you know? So anyways, I went to a meeting and I was just at a point where I was disgusted with myself. I couldn't look at my reflection in the mirror. I was crossing the street, like not wanting to look if there were cars coming because I was hoping there were, you know, I and this was at a time I'd been trying to control my drinking for 3.5 years. And so I'm always in shock when I read like Dr. Bob's Nightmare or something, and he tries to control his drinking for like decades. And seriously, like it's not a judgment on either situation, but like, I can tell you if you're a young person and you're trying to get sober and there's anyone telling you that like you're lucky because you avoided pain or whatever, like that was like, I hated hearing that. I was like, I am miserable. I wanted to just die for like years, you know? And so just, you know, just in case that's anybody's experience in here, like your experience is valid. And similarly, like your experience is valid if you're getting sober and you're older. But you know, I found, a sponsor at my first meeting back, because she came over and introduced herself to me. And like that alcohol counselor, she didn't really even ask me questions about me. Like she kind of just asked me sort of surface level questions and did what we do here, which is she talked about herself. And, she talked about her experience coming into AA, and it was, and I think that that's such an important element of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we don't, tell people what they should do. We tell people our experience. And if they would like to pick up the kit of spiritual tools that I've also picked up and continue to try to pick up, then come pick them up while I'm picking them up, at the same time, you know, and we do it together. And so that was really like, it was really different than any way that anyone else had approached me about it. Except for that counselor who, like, I wasn't willing to be honest with at all, because I didn't know he was an alcoholic. And so I asked this woman, you know, I that was a Saturday night. It was a young people's meeting in Brookline. And I asked this woman to be my sponsor the following week. And, you know, really what happened is I just did what she told me to do, you know, and I guess I should clarify, like, it's not that my sponsor's not told me to do things, you know, because I said, we don't tell people what to do. It's that I knew what she was telling me to do were things that she had done or was doing. And so I didn't feel like she was coming down at me from some place of judgment or superiority. I very much felt that we were in the boat together, you know? And so, you know, I started going through the steps with her. I started, just doing what she told me to do. Like, if she told me to get a home group, I got a home group. If she told me, at the time, her boyfriend, now husband, was speaking at this meeting downtown and she told me to come and I didn't want to go, and I would go anyways, you know? And I didn't have a car. I had to take the train to meetings, and I joined the same home group that she was a part of, and I just followed her around. I just did what she did. And all I can say is that, like, I don't think that the time that I got sober, I was more miserable. Like, I think some people talk about, like, I knew that time I was done. I don't really feel that way. I had felt like I was done a lot of times. All I really know for sure is that I did different things. I took different actions than all the times previously. So I don't know if I was, like, more willing at that time or whatever, but all the other times before when I had tried to stop drinking, I made a firm resolution, but never a decision, you know, like they talk about in the book. And so I started going through the steps with her, and I had gone through the steps for the first time, I think, by the time I was 5 months sober, and I started sponsoring other people. And, you know, my journey since then has been that, you know, I've always had a sponsor. I've always had a home group, and I've always been trying to sponsor other people, and help other people. And, I have gotten involved in AA. Like, you know, it's funny to think of all the years I sort of, like, danced around AA. You know, I like the expression of, like, you know, come all the way in and sit all the way down, you know, and that when I actually did that, I began to see that there was more to AA than just not drinking, and that I could actually have a life here that was contented and free. And that's something that I hadn't had. You know, I think they talk about it, like, that we don't necessarily even return to a previous state of life, you know, like, that I'm actually given a new life, you know, because the thing was, is I was full of fear, like I was talking about, from as long as I can remember. And I'm not saying that I'm not fearful today, because I'm a human being, and of course I am. But this design for living that AA has given me has completely transformed my entire life, the entire life of my family. You know, I made amends to all of my family members. I made amends to every friend that I harmed. I made amends to the places I stole money from. I made amends to that college. I made amends to the justice people at that college, you know, and, like, cleaning up my life and going back and picking up all the pieces of my soul that I left along the way in a payment for being able to continue to drink without any impediments, you know, has completely changed the person that I am today. And, you know, in my time in AA, I've worked the steps, I think, like, around once a year. And I continue to work steps 10 and 11 on a daily basis. And, you know, I have a prayer life, I practice meditation, but all I can say too is, like, if you're new, like, it all started with just being willing to do whatever it was that was the next thing, you know, the next thing was, you know, okay, my home group is having a group inventory. I remember I was probably like 6 months sober and my home group had a group inventory, which is, in case you don't do them often at this group, it's just like basically like an inventory, like you would do a fourth step on a person for a group, you know? And I remember my home group was doing one and my sponsor was like, are you coming? And I was like, oh no, I don't care what the group does. So I'm not going to be there. And, she was like, well, you know, that's not what a home group is. A home group, you show up, you do service and it's your home. You have to be willing to take care of it. And I hope I'll see you there. And she hung up and I'm like, I like was so irritated. So I, of course, like, but I did what she told me to do. So I got on the train, which just boggles my mind. I am like the most stubborn, resistant person. I don't do things willingly very often. So sometimes it's like so obvious to me that that must have been a higher power, because like that is not of Anna, you know. But so I went to this stupid group inventory, and every time it came around to me and they asked for my opinion on something, I would say pass. And I would give her like a dirty rug face look, you know, and she didn't care, you know, like, because the thing was, is like, I took actions against what my head was telling me to do, because I was very afraid of drinking again. And, you know, I don't only take action today because I'm afraid of drinking, but, you know, I also like the results produced by AA. That's also another reason why I do the actions today. My dog is like burrowing behind me. Sorry if you can hear that. You know, but the reality is that I do still take action because I'm afraid of drinking today. I think, like, you know, I've been talking a lot with my sponsor lately about this idea that, you know, just because I'm like a years away from a drink doesn't mean that it's not about drinking anymore. You know, yes, of course I get an opportunity here to work on my relationship with God, and I get an opportunity to, you know, have a relationship with my husband and a relationship with my family, and, you know, ask God to remove all these character defects and get this, you know, really improved quality of life. But I'm under no delusion that like I'm past the likelihood of picking up a drink again if my spiritual condition goes untreated long enough. And so, you know, what I do today is I really try to continue to practice the same types of things with the same, at least, zip code-ish level of willingness that I had when I was brand new. Because, you know, I never want to get to a place where I think that I am good, you know? Because if any time I say I've got it, it's, you better watch out. You know, I don't got anything, you know, I need God's help and a fellowship and a sponsor and sponsees. I need those things to be able to stay accountable and to be able to actually have a relationship with God that isn't just Anna talking to Anna, you know? And, because the thing is it sounds often like it's, you know, God's voice and Anna's voice are astonishingly similar at times, you know? And so I need to have like a fellowship of people that, I'm surrounded with that helps me discern the difference between those two things. And so, you know, what I do with that is I just continue to try to stay in the middle of that receiving line, you know, of a sponsor, a sponsee, and staying involved in AA. I got involved. I had two home groups in my first, like, I don't know how many years I had two home groups. It was a while. And then I ended up just having one and being a member of the other, whatever. It's kind of like semantics at some point, but, I got involved in Boston's bid for the International Conference of Young People. I was involved in the host committee for the international conference that was held in Boston a couple of years ago. You know, and not because like I wanted to all the time either, you know, like I'm not a joiner. I don't like, I have a much easier time with the service and the recovery parts of the triangle than I do with the unity part. You know, I've always been someone who has to be told, like, you know, go hang out with people, you know, because I'm full of fear. I'm afraid of what you think about me. It's much easier if I spend time alone, you know, I don't have to interact with anybody. I don't have to get into weird conversations and, you know, whatever. But you wouldn't like, by knowing me, you might not know that, because I've been taught in AA to just do it anyways, you know? So I'll go to fellowship. I joined the Boston bid committee at first because, you know, I was feeling like, like, but everyone in AA hated me. Honestly, I was going through this phase where I was like so full of self-doubt that I felt like everyone hated me all the time. And my sponsor was like, why don't you go spend time trying to help more people? Why don't you go spend time going and joining like a group of people that you don't feel a part of and being of service there? And so I went to this stupid bid committee meeting and I did that and I hated it. And I did it anyways. And then I ended up like making real friends, you know, and being a part of something that I otherwise would have missed, you know, and that honestly, like having a sponsor, and I know this is kind of like all over the place, but having a sponsor who I've been willing to take her suggestions has been vital in making sure that I stay in the middle of the triangle, you know, and of the fellowship, because, you know, I've been working with the same sponsor for over 7 years now. And, you know, and I know that everyone has different experiences, but having people, whether it's your sponsor or a fellow in AA or whatever, that know you over a period of time has been immensely helpful to me, because they've been able to, you know, they talk about in the big book, friends of the newcomer can often see the change before the person can see it themselves. And, you know, being able to mirror back to you how you've grown, how your relationship with God has improved, areas in your life that you've let go a little bit more that maybe you didn't notice. And then also being able to show you areas where like you may be more agnostic than you think you are. You may not be letting God into that area and you think that that's, you know, you don't see it, you know? And so that's been immensely helpful to me. And getting to, you know, I'm somebody who, I'm married to another alcoholic, you know, getting to practice these principles in all of my affairs has looked like, you know, really reading those later chapters in the big book, reading to wives, reading the family afterward. Like, you know, I know sometimes people call them like the forgotten chapters or whatever. And some of them like have like outdated language and stuff, but you know, those types of things, like taking what the big book is saying and applying it to all areas of my life, my work life, my marriage, my relationship with my family, my relationship with my friends, has been hugely helpful for me. And those are the types of ways where it's like, I got a new life. I didn't get my old one back. And maybe that freaks you out. But for me, that was like hopeful because I didn't want my old one back. You know, I was so done with myself by the time that I came to AA and really tried that I just wanted the drinking to stop. And I wanted to be okay. I didn't feel like I was okay, you know, and, in times going through the steps since, you know, like I was able to see, I'm a big proponent of like, of going through the steps more than once, because for me, like the first time through, I, you know, I saw what I could see and that wasn't really a lot. Like when I went to my sponsor's house with my fourth step, I told her before I went, I was like, to be honest, I have a lot of spots that are blank. Like the parts where it's like, where am I to blame? I was like, I drew a complete blank. Like these were some of the things that it was like, I'm not to blame. I've been convincing people that I have no part in this for years. And I believe it too, you know? And so I went to her house and that first experience, like I said, like really was that, like the reason I like that visual is like the chink in the walls that my ego had built. Like it cracked me open just enough where I was like, I honestly thought my sponsor, my first sponsor, was the smartest person I had ever met in my entire life. Like she would say like, well, how did you like form expectations that set you up to be disappointed? And that's really not that other person's fault. And I'd be like, oh my God, I don't, how did you know that? You know, like, and well, it sounds like you're taking that personally and maybe it had nothing to do with you. And I was like, and I would go home and I would like tell my mom and she'd be like, wow, she is the smart. Like we both thought she was the smartest person that we'd ever met. She's still my good friend today. And I was in her wedding. But you know, like come to find out, she's just talking about what people talk about in AA, what's in the big book, you know, but like subsequent times through the steps, I was able to see more. And so, you know, like in my second inventory, I wrote out that resentment at the president of my university who told me he wished he could kick me out, but he didn't have enough evidence. I hated him. I hated him. I thought he was cruel. I thought he misunderstood me. One of my big things was he was making an example out of me. That was a very egotistical thing that I thought a lot. People were always making examples out of me. To scare other people off from behaving the same way I was behaving or something. I don't know. It's like so silly. I really thought it though. So I was able to look at that inventory and my sponsor was like, so let me get this straight. He told you that you were dishonest and that your behavior seemed problematic because you were drinking so much and that you needed to get it under control, in so many words. And now you are in AA and talk about how you're dishonest and realize that your drinking was out of control and that you needed to put a stop to, you know, the behavior you were doing. And she was like, so let me get it straight. So you're in agreement with what he said to you. And I was like, well, I guess if you put it like that, you know, yeah, I suppose I don't think what he said was so out of line, you know, and again, just being willing to, again, to have a new experience and crack open the armor a little bit more. And I hope to continue to have that willingness. And so anyway, she said that to me and I went and I made amends to him and, you know, come to find out that he, you know, had the experience of being a president of another university in the Boston area and having a student, an 18-year-old student, die in their first couple of weeks of school from alcohol poisoning. And the reason that he had these one-on-one meetings with students who got taken away in ambulances from school events like I did was because he met with his best friend who was 25 years sober in AA or something. And he said, you know, and he really wanted to get to a place where he was able to say something to people's parents and look them in the eye if that ever happened again and say that he did everything he possibly could to try to help. And he said, you know, I may have gotten it wrong, but I really was honestly trying to just get through to people that what they were doing was unsafe. I mean, how do you script those things? Those were things that I was so angry at him. I felt so disconnected from my entire college experience because I felt like the ugly duckling, the one that they didn't want, the black sheep and all that stuff. And come to find out he was just trying to help. And I just couldn't see that stuff. And I couldn't even really fully see it like on paper in my inventory as much as I could when I went in the flesh and saw him sitting across the table from me, earnestly saying to me, I just never wanted to be in that position again where I could say that I hadn't done anything, you know? And it was like an amazing amends. And I have plenty of other amazing amends stories. I've never made an amends where I wasn't feeling like so incredibly nervous beforehand. But I continue, I think I have one outstanding amends that I tried to make to a hotel in Spain. I owe them money for destroying property in their room. And I tried to call and make amends recently, like a few weeks ago. And they thought I was like pranking them or something. So I have to figure out a way to get that sorted out. I'll just finish up by saying, you know, like the last thing that has been like super, super important for me, in addition to like, you know, making all of the amends and really practicing the principles of the prayer and meditation and the 10th step and like, you know, constantly seeking to hold God's hand for longer periods of time throughout the day without letting go. Like the other piece of the puzzle that has been super crucial for me has been sponsorship and not being sponsored. I think I've talked sufficiently about that, but sponsoring other people. And I'm not somebody who, you know, like I would for like a lot of years sober, I dealt with one of my biggest fears is what I think you think about me. And so I don't know about anybody else, but my experience is that if that is one of your biggest fears, sponsoring can be very, very hard because you have to, like one of the biggest gifts that my sponsors have given me is that they cared more about what I was doing than how I felt about what they were saying. And so it has been a journey for me to get to a place where I have been able to give people that I sponsor the same amount of respect as I have been given. And be willing to step on their toes rather than step on their grave. And so I can just, you know, I'll say frankly, like I used to get so resentful at parts in the Big Book that would say, and they don't use the word sponsoring, but like working with others is the bright spot of our lives. And I would have these sponsees that I just like, I would get on the phone with them and they would yell at me or they would, you know, not do like what I suggested. and just sort of like take me hostage on the phone for 30 minutes about whatever. And, you know, just all sorts of things. I had a lot of people yell at me for sure. But the thing was, I would stay on the phone, you know, and just like growing in sponsorship for me has been a huge part of my sobriety. And the thing that is so important is like, I have always thought that like, you know, at certain times I remember thinking that that was, that, you know, I remember saying to my sponsor one time that, oh, I feel closest to God when I'm on a hike in nature, you know, no one's around. And I remember her saying to me, well, you know, I would actually say that you're probably closer to and growing your relationship with God more when you're in the most difficult conversations with sponsees that you've had. And that really has honestly been my experience. Like, I am a more effective sponsor today by all the pitfalls, but I also like my experience is that like the growth doesn't really happen when I'm feeling like everything's awesome, unfortunately. And you know, sponsoring for me today is a bright spot. It is, but it's because I've been forced to grow my relationship with God enough that my being okay isn't dependent on what anybody thinks about me, including sponsees. And what I thought that, you know, I don't know why exactly sponsorship is such a crucial part of the AA program, but I will say that I think that, the same way that you find out about your character defects by getting into a relationship, I think you also similarly find out about your character defects by being in relationship with other alcoholics that intimately. And so, you know, I found out like what it is, where are the areas that I'm not trusting God? It becomes very obvious in my relationships with sponsees, because either it's something that I'm trying to talk to them about what they're doing and I'm not doing it. I'm trying to get them to have a certain opinion about me. So I'm fabricating, you know, what I think or what I'm saying so that I can manipulate what their reaction is, you know, whatever it is. And I remember at certain times, like when I've had really challenging times with sponsees, like my sponsor would just tell me, well, when do you want to learn this? Do you want to learn it with your children? Do you want to learn it with a different family member? And so I'll just say that like, if you're not sponsoring anybody or you're not sponsoring anybody who's new or, you know, it's obviously it's harder in these times with the pandemic, like it's harder to connect with people on Zoom, but I'll just say that like, I think that for me, like in addition to practicing like the daily disciplines internally and being connected to a sponsor for myself, like I have to remember that like, this is only as good to the extent that I give it away. And so like, I continue to try to be of service in my home group, even though it's online and even though I've switched home groups during the pandemic. So I'm literally a member of a home group that I haven't met anybody in person. But I'm still there. I still try to get there early. I still try to stay late. I still try to see if somebody's new and looks like they're struggling in their little box. Because for me, like my life is dependent on my constant thought of others and how I can help meet their needs, you know? And in that, the irony, and I think why we have to continue to work all of those like later 10 and 11 and 12 steps is because like, for me, they very much so in the past 8 years have worked in conjunction with one another. And like, I see things in sponsorship that then I bring into prayer and meditation, and I see things in prayer and meditation that then I can talk about with my sponsees and ways that I can be useful and all that kind of stuff. So I think I'm just coming up to the end of my time. If you're new here tonight, or if you're not new and you're struggling with the pandemic or just feeling disconnected or whatever, please feel free to reach out to me. I know that we have a little bit of time afterwards, but not a little bit of time. We have like another half an hour, but if you want to talk, I'm happy to share my number with anybody. And I just appreciate the opportunity to share. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Anna. That was awesome. I'm going to allow everybody to unmute and say thanks.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anna.
Awesome.
God bless you, Anna. Thank you so much for your share.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you, guys.
All right, I'm going to take the meeting back and we'll give Anna a little bit of a break. The seventh tradition. Let's see. The Seven Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seven Tradition is essential. At every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. And for everybody still in the room, I'm going to put out another call to, there is a user called Questions. It's really Larry. But if you have any questions that you'd like Anna to answer, then please submit them to the user Questions at this time. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will take a couple of announcements for the good of AA by show of hands. Anybody? All righty then. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All our meetings are recorded and up to date on the website, simpleactions.net. There's also, for anybody who would like, a place to sign up for to be included in email announcements. It's a low volume email list. We just send out emails about the speakers that we're having and upcoming events. So that's that. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. Let's see what questions we got coming in here for Anna. Okay, the first one is, young people in AA saved my life and I miss it, especially Florida WIPA. Can you talk more about your WIPA experience and how you were involved, specifically how WIPA affected your sobriety?
Sure. So the one of the meetings that I was a member of from the very beginning was a young people's meeting, which I think is in some ways distinct from like young people's conferences and service committees. But that young people's meeting was a huge part of my sobriety. And when I was I can say that one of the reasons I think it was so big was it was on a Saturday night and I got sober when I was 22 and I felt like such a loser. And so I felt like it was so nice to go somewhere where like we got food after every meeting. And sometimes we would like go out to various places and just to be with people my own age was so nice. And I think really, really important for me. And then I joined the first bid committee in Boston, like I said, because I felt like everyone in AA hated me. I've told that story to the bid and host committee. And so I joined it because my sponsor was like, why don't you just like go try to help other people in AA and stop trying to think about what they think about you. And so that was what I did. And so the conferences themselves, like I mostly have experience being at conferences either to outreach the bid committee or the host committee or to bid for IKIPA or to then host IKIPA. So I don't have as much experience of like being a young person attending conferences and having like an experience like that. But what I can say is I think like, if you want to learn about the traditions and concepts, there are a lot of like active people talking about the traditions and concepts in young people's service committees and like having to write different bid requirements for hosting conferences and stuff and looking at writing up service positions and creating like bylaws and stuff like that. I know it sounds boring, but it's actually, I think, super, super helpful if you ever want to be involved in like starting groups or anything like that. Or if you want to start a group and you feel like you don't know how, like getting involved in those committees. I think like young people there, I think there's actually someone now who's a trustee who like got his start in young people's AA. So it's definitely like a really awesome place to be of service. And there's just like so many conferences and committees to be a part of. So I really have benefited from being like on those and trying to help. So that's basically my experience.
Thank you. When you came in, were you God resistant or willing and open-minded from day one?
That's a good question. No, I was God irrelevant. Like I just didn't care. I thought that it was a nice idea, but I thought it was insufficient for sure. It would be like, you know, I would call my sponsor and say like whatever was going on with me, and then she'd be like, have you prayed? Have you helped somebody? I'm like, that's not really what I was talking about, you know? And so I was definitely somebody, I remember early on, like being in the car with my sponsor and being like, she said to me something similar almost. She was like, you know, how do you feel about the God stuff, quote unquote. And, I said, like, I didn't really care. And so I've been through like in subsequent times through the steps, like I just finished step two. So I'm on step three now. And, you know, in subsequent times through the steps, like I've been able to sort of consider how to like grow my conception of God to become bigger than when I came in. But like when I started, I would say that, my sponsor, like, even though I know that's not like a very popular thing to say, but like kind of like my sponsor and my group were kind of like my higher power in the sense that I was like, they know more than I do about how to stay sober. I think it was really problematic if you thought that like far into your sobriety, because that sounds like reliance on things human. But I think when you're new, like listening to your sponsors dictates and like the group that you're a part of, I don't know, that worked for me. And obviously like, you know, find someone that you think like, you know, you can trust and relate to and stuff, not just any random person. But that was sort of where I started. And then like when I started to get more experience with my own like conception of a higher power, I think that's what the steps is really designed to do. So it's not really that shocking that like when I came in, I didn't have an idea of what that was going to look like. So I just borrowed basically what my sponsor and my group were telling me to do. So that's my experience with them.
So you mentioned that, you know, going through the steps in several iterations, specifically, how has step three changed for you from that first time to subsequent times?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess for me, I mean, one of the things that I like in the big book in step three is where, you know, after they write the prayer, they say like the wording was quite optional so long as we express the desire. So it's certain times through the book, my sponsor has instructed me to write my own third step. And you can find online, even like Dr. Bob has his own version of a third step that's online, if you're curious. And so I think like writing it in a way that made sense to me was helpful. I still say it the way it's written most days. But I would say like the biggest way that the third step has changed for me is like in what I'm willing to let go of at that time in my life, because like making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, it's never been that like, you know, in step three, my will and my life are changed, because it's just a decision, you know, and you have to follow it up with action. But I guess what's changed for me is that at different years, my will and my life, my conception of what my will and my life entails that I'm actually willing to give to God is bigger. like it expands more areas of my life, you know, like I'd say now I'm more willing to give God certain areas that previously, like, I didn't even think about when I considered saying a third step, you know, I didn't even see them as being relevant. But I feel like, I mean, my sponsor would say, like, the distance from your third step is how many opinions you have. And so, like, waking up to, like, when I even have an opinion, I know that sounds silly, but, like, sometimes I've found that, like, I didn't even realize that when I was running into problems with sponsees, for example, like, I couldn't even do a third step on that before I had the problem with it. Like, I didn't even understand that that was something I should be praying about. So I think that that's the biggest thing.
Awesome. Would you be willing to give an example of how step 6 and 7 have worked in your life?
Sure. I guess the best example I can think of, like, when it has been the most, like, stark, before I came into AA, I really thought that like jealousy in relationships meant that you really cared. You know, like if someone was jealous of your behavior, it meant that they cared that you didn't behave a certain way. So I thought that was like a good thing. And with my husband, when we were dating, I remember running into some problems with being jealous of certain behaviors. Like, you know, we're both in AA, like we're both friendly with a lot of men and women. And I remember being really jealous of stuff early on that, like, I honestly now thinking back on it is like so crazy to me. But one of the biggest reasons why it came to mind for step 6 and 7 was like, it was a defect that I think a lot of defects like are adaptations that people take on as ways to try to manage something that's unmanageable. You know, I was trying to manage my relationship with my ex-boyfriend and he didn't want to be with me. And so he would cheat on me and he would tell me that he didn't want to be with me. And I would just think that that was just like a minor roadblock, you know? And so like I had developed this sort of like well-grooved pathway of trying to manage that by like, you know, sort of being hyper-vigilant about his behavior with people. And I had carried that into my relationship with my boyfriend at the time, who now we're married. And I remember talking a lot about it where like I really reached this point where I could see that it wasn't serving God anymore. It wasn't serving the relationship I was currently in. It wasn't even based on the relationship I was currently in. I had no reason to continue like using this tool that I had acquired by trying to manage something that like God didn't see fit to be in my life. You know, so I remember like doing a sex and like kind of like going through the steps, like in a way kind of quickly with like this one thing where I wrote out like a sex inventory piece and I was able to like really earnestly pray about having that removed and then make the amends to my boyfriend. And then I genuinely have not struggled with again, because it was like a really stark example of like, I saw that it was really not helpful. Like it was just like, God graced me with that willingness to really see that very clearly. With other defects of character, it's my opinion and experience that like, it's very different. It's a different prayer for God to remove the defects that you don't like versus the defects that are standing in the way of your usefulness to God and other people. Like that's a very different prayer. And so my experience is that like there are certain things about myself that like I continue to do and I continue to run up against, like, you know, not liking the results produced by what the action is. But I also really truly believe that, like, in the seventh step, it says that you give God everything, good and bad, meaning like, I'm like, leave me with whatever's going to be useful, right? So like, meaning that I don't get to decide whether or not something is going to be put to good use by God. There are other defects for me, like clearly jealousy was not going to be something that was going to be useful. But there are other defects that like I've had to keep as pieces of like real spiritual business. And if I'm not watching for them, I heard a speaker last week say that like God will remove them, but they are not disappeared. Like they're just off to the side. And so like, depending on what my spiritual condition is like there are certain defects of character that like at certain times they still do something for me. Like that's really like what a defect of character is for me, is like, I get something out of it. Like I said, like I thought jealousy was an effective tool to show people that you love them. Once I saw that wasn't true, it didn't really serve a purpose for me anymore. So why would I want only the negative effects? But the ones that have negative effects, but I still see some purpose in doing, I pick them up sometimes, you know? So, that's it.
Thank you. You shared something that really rang with me. And I think it's a rather common experience too, where we get set up with a sort of an expectation that these resentments are going to be taken care of in steps 4 and 5. But I think a lot of us, and some of them do, and a lot of them don't even begin to heal until we go fully through the amends process. And so I wonder if you'd share some amends experiences, and particularly interested in how it went with the alcohol counselor.
Oh yeah. So I guess with my immediate family, like I was pretty, I don't know if that's the right word to use. I was going to say that I was lucky, but I don't really know that I think that that's true. But my immediate family didn't really they kind of just wanted me to be okay. So they weren't like the most, like when I asked them, like from their perspective, what was it like and all that kind of stuff, like they were just kind of like, they shared a little bit, but I think mostly they just wanted it to, me to be okay, me to stay sober, which I never guarantee in an amends because I don't know for sure that that's possible. I don't want to lie. But I always try to say that I'll do my best, but, I guess two amends. So one being the alcohol counselor and one being this other person, the alcohol counselor I made amends to, and mostly what I was doing, because like I hadn't necessarily like harmed him in the sense like he wasn't somebody that I was rude to or anything, you know, like but I've been taught, and I really believe that sometimes amends for me is like the harm that I did was like I didn't acknowledge that they were trying to help and that their job must like really suck sometimes, you know, like, I mean, I think part of the amends for that person was like, showing him that the work he was doing mattered, you know, that like, I did hear what he said at the time, even though I didn't act like I did. Because like, I mean, like I talked about, he was very impactful and I remember his demeanor very well, but like, if you watched my interactions with him at the time, it's not like I was rude, but I was certainly not out of my way thankful for what he was trying to do. And so a lot of my amends have been in the form of like past due thank yous, for people like that, for people that I wasn't outrightly, you know, harmful to, but like the lack was the harm. And so he, at the time, I think I was like 2 years sober, and, he made some comment about how like, he was like, are you new or something like that to the program? And I said that I had about 2 years, and he was like, oh, well, you're new to me until you have 5. And so I thought that was kind of funny and humbling, but you know, he had like 3 decades of sobriety, so it's understandable. Then the other amends story that I guess I'll share, and I sometimes share this just because like, I think it's important. Like there's that part of the big book that says, in 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens or something. And so I had made like a good amount of amends, and there was like at least one amends that I owed for like being a part of a person cheating on their significant other. And the significant other knew about it and had yelled at me like a number of times. And I always just like cried and like was like, it's so horrible. Like life is so hard for me, as if I didn't like lay in my bed, you know? And so I owed her amends, and I had made some amends. They'd all been like to my family. They were all so easy. And then I reached out to her, to this woman, and I was just not expecting like the response I got, which was like, you know, it was probably like 3 years after it had happened, and she was still dating the person, and she wrote me back basically like a 5-paragraph essay on what a horrible person I was and that she never wanted to hear from me, that she was glad that it had sat on my conscience this long, and that she hoped I went to hell and all this stuff. And I was so upset. I just was so upset. And she called me some names that I'm not even going to repeat in this meeting. And I remember I left work because I read it at work for some reason, which was a terrible idea because I started crying and I had to leave. But I remember like, you know, I call my sponsor and it was like one of those amends that I like just was never going to make because I knew how horrible it was going to be. And then see how horrible it was. Like I knew it was going to be so horrible. And like the thing that the reason I share it is not at all to discourage making amends, because for a few reasons, the first being that like, I'm here to tell the tale. I lived through it. I'm okay. And it was the one that I was like, I'm never going to be able to make this, you know? And so like, just to say that like, she does hate me just as much as I thought she did. It was horrible. I did cry a lot and I felt like a piece of garbage. But here's the thing is that like, it was important because the second reason being that like, I did some part of me while I felt like such a piece of trash for doing that. Like, I mean, I felt so bad about that, like really, really terrible. But at the same time, some part of me did hang my hat on the idea that like, I'm just a nice girl who's made some mistakes and you guys really need to let it go, you know? And so it was like really important for me to hear like, you know, from my perspective being this woman, you're not a nice girl, you know, that wasn't okay what you did. Your behavior did really affect another person, like a lot, you know? And it kind of smashed that delusion for me that like, I hadn't really hurt anyone but myself, you know? And that was really important for me because it showed me that like, you know, that I can cause real harm. And then the third reason I say that is because like what I did was I called my sponsor. My sponsor said to me, I'm so proud of you. I know that you were really afraid to do that. What are you doing tonight? And I went to a commitment. Like I went to a, you know, like share stories with like a meeting or whatever in Boston. And I just continued to walk through it. And like, you know, I get to, like, I remember certain things that my sponsor said to me that like, you know, anyone but that girl and maybe that girl's mother is going to look at what you were trying to do and know that you were trying to do the right thing, you know, because we all make mistakes and we all like you trying to own up to it is what's important. And like, I really know today that if given the opportunity, I would make it right, you know, but it talks about in the big book, it shouldn't matter if they throw you out of their office. Like there are some mistakes that you can never fully write. Like I can never fully write that mistake, you know, what I can do is stay out of their way so that they can be happy without me, you know, because I was in the way. And I don't know, I guess like, I guess I think that's important because like, not every amends for me has gone like, you're overreacting. Like, don't worry about it, you know? And sometimes I get pissed when I hear people say that that's how every amends that they've ever made has gone. Like some amends for me, I needed to hear like, you know, that was not okay. And then similarly, like at different times in my sobriety, when I was feeling really, really low, like I got to hear from people things like, I was just bummed you weren't around, you know? And I got to like, at times when I felt like really, really low, it was a reminder that like, I am important, you know, like I, like being around, like my friendship is important to people. And I found that like, I've always sort of gotten what I needed, you know, like whether it was that I kind of needed to be told that I did hurt people or sort of like knocked down or knocked up. They've always sort of gotten me back to like a humility, like right-sizedness in the world. So that was kind of long.
Sorry. Awesome. We're kind of at the end of the time. We got like four questions and they're about sponsorship. So what I propose to do is I'm just going to throw all four of these questions out here and you pick apart whatever jumps out at you. But these four questions are, how do you take sponsees through the steps and traditions? Can you elaborate more on putting aside what sponsees think of you? Do you have a limit on how many people you sponsor? Balance? Question mark. How do you know when you're ready to take the leap to become a sponsor? Any of that?
Okay. Some of them are easier than others. So one, I'd say you're ready to be a sponsor as soon as you've been through the steps. I know that there's some places in Boston, I know for sure that say like, don't sponsor people until you have a certain amount of time. I've not found that direction anywhere in our literature. And so I try to like, remember that there are a lot of opinions in AA, but like our basis is in the text. So, it's my belief that I don't think I would even have stayed if I hadn't been sponsoring, like, you know, when I had less than 6 months. How do I take sponsees through the steps and traditions? I usually take sponsees through the steps first. And in Zoom times, like my sponsorship family has been doing different things. Like we did like a traditions and concepts study over 12 weeks for like a little bit of time. So that was online. So, but if I'm going through the traditions, I would then like probably do it out of the 12 and 12 and the concepts out of the service manual. Setting aside what sponsees think of me, I guess like the most practical tips I can give in a short amount of time, and you're welcome to talk to me extensively about it afterwards, but I pray before every time I pick up the phone, every single time, because it's not my conversation. It's not my sponsee. It's not my job to convince them to do anything. And they're not mine. They're God's sponsee, you know, that like, I don't have to say something to keep them as my sponsee. If they don't want to work with me, that's okay. That my job is really to be of service. And the another big thing for me, just because I can oscillate from one side to the other, is like, if they are being abusive in any way, you can always calmly say, sounds like you're really frustrated. Why don't we talk when you're less frustrated and get off the phone? Because I've been in a lot of conversations where I was like, if I have to keep putting up with all of these a-holes, I'm not staying in AA. You guys like are so mean and blah, blah. It's just not a character defect I've ever had. I've never yelled at a sponsor. I'm not above it, but I just never have. And so I didn't know how to deal with it. And so if that's anything that's been happening to anybody, like that's just my experience, is like, you don't have to, this isn't meant to be so unpleasant. And I can't remember what the fourth question was, but.
Is there a limit to the number of sponsees?
Oh, no.
Bam.
I think like the best answer is like, one too few, you know. I mean, I've said no to a couple of people when like I really didn't think I could help them because they had certain things going on. Or like I was in a really low place one time and like talked about it with my sponsor, and like I couldn't be helpful to the person because I was really not doing well. But no, most of the time, like I've not had an experience where I come from a sponsorship family that like my sponsor sponsors a lot of people. So that's like sort of the example that's been given to me. So.
Right on. Thank you so much. This was just absolutely amazing. Everybody will get the opportunity to unmute after the Lord's Prayer and say thank you again. And I wonder if Ebony would read the last two paragraphs on page 164, please. I should probably give you the ability to unmute. I whiffed that one. All right, once again, you should be able to unmute now, Ebony.
There we go. Hey y'all, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. A Vision for You, Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you. Until then.
Amen.
Thank you, Ebony. Thank everyone. Thank Larry for wrangling the questions. Thank you all for participating. Let's virtually circle up, virtually hold hands, and actually say the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Thank you, Anna.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
We need you, Anna.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anna. It was great to hear from you again.
Yes. Anna, that was incredible.
Thank you,
incredible.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.